Hi, thanks, Rob. So I'm the welcomer, so I'll say a few brief welcoming remarks. For those of you who don't know, Perimeter started a little more than 5 years ago, and it was our intention to have a facility, obviously, of this size and scope to be able to run a whole host of programs and workshops. So we're delighted to be able to move into high gear this year, because we just opened in October, and it's wonderful to have all of you here today, and it's particularly wonderful to have a close collaboration with the Fields Institute as part of this string theory theme year. So I encourage all of you, those who have come before and seen us grow from a much smaller facility, to those who haven't been here before, to wander around and when talks aren't going on, obviously talk to people who are here. There are even a few people here who aren't string theorists who I'm sure you'd like to talk to as well. And just to sum up very briefly, I'd like to say thank you to the conference organizers who did such a great job putting all of this together. In particular, Jean-Louis, Gary Hsu, and Rob Myers. And I'm not going to hand it back to Rob. I know it's painfully difficult first thing in the morning to get all excited, but I'm not going to hand off the microphone unless people can give a round of applause to Rob, because Rob has done such a fantastic job, not only with this particular workshop, but with the entire string theory theme year and driving the whole string theory agenda at Perimeter. So, well, I guess it's not an agenda. It's a program at Perimeter. So Rob,
okay, before we get started, there are a few logistical things that I was asked to review. They all actually appear on a sheet that's in front of the schedule and should be inside your folder. The first item is that your name tag actually serves as a meal ticket. Not only are we going to stimulate your minds with exciting physics, but we're going to stimulate your palate with an exciting menu of lunches and dinners up in the bistro. But you have to have your name tag, and there's some details there described on how that'll work. The other one is computers. Everyone wants to do email. Unfortunately, we don't yet have our wireless set up, but if you go down here out into the atrium on the left-hand side, there's the library, and we have 7 PCs and 3 ports for laptops. So everybody should be able to do their email from there. And the last one is that you all met, or I hope you were all greeted by Jessica out in the atrium. And if you have any other questions or concerns while you're here at PI, she's the point person, and she'll help you as best she can. So to start the morning session, I'll hand it off to the chair then, John.
Thanks, Rob. So let me just remark that I'm impressed by this nice new facility here. Last time I visited, it was under construction. So anyway, I'll introduce the first speaker, Gordy Kane, and I'm pleased to introduce him because last summer he introduced me, so chance to get even. And so the title is What Counts as String Phenomenology?
That one. You might want to turn it off if you're going to mutter. I'm going to try and talk about the three things, the three subjects that are listed there in my time. Increasingly, more things are counted as string phenomenology, and so I'm just going to spend some time, of course, mentioning a little bit of work I've done occasionally, arguing that this subfield is becoming more and more a big one and a successful and healthy one. Then I'm going to focus a little bit on collider physics, because there's been increasing excitement about the fact that LHC is probably actually going to come and work and do stuff. And then the organizers asked if we could try a little thing to get ahead of the rest of the world. And so we're going to report here the actual results of the first data run of LHC in the form that the experimenters would basically report it. And by the end of the week, the organizers expect that you all will have identified how supersymmetry is broken from the hints in the data and the underlying string theory, 10-dimensional string theory. So I'll give you the information you need to do that. So what counts as string phenomenology? Well, you all know that the things on the top are used all the time as that, and then the rest of the things that I've listed here, and one could put some more things, are sometimes used. There's not been too much work on particularly in deep brain models, about why the forces are unified when it's not automatically built in. The German group has done a lot of work on that, and the Spanish one a little bit, and there's been some other work. Langacker will talk some about exotics and discovering them. I'm going to just focus a minute on electrolytic symmetry breaking and these flavor issues in the next few minutes as areas, and there isn't time to do much more. I keep being asked, what is string phenomenology? So here's a definition of string phenomenology. It's the area of research which wants to explain the things in this list. So maybe there's a little bit more to add to the list, maybe not, but I'll take this as the definition of string phenomenology. It's not a very concise one, but that's okay. We can improve that later. So you can read the list and see the things in it. Basically, the point is that these include a lot of important questions that I and a lot of us would really like to see answers to, and that no other subfield is working much on. String theorists don't, maybe 1 or 2% of string theory papers work on concretely on studying these actual phenomena, or someone might argue 5%, but it's certainly not a main area of string theory, and it's certainly not of model building or phenomenological theory where you always assume things that you put in. But you might really be able to explain all of these. So that's my definition of string phenomenology. Why are lots of us excited about string theory? We've been told we should be excited because it's a quantum theory of gravity, and that's fair enough. But I think more importantly, it's, to me at least, it's because string theory really can address a huge number of questions. So here's a list of the questions that I would like to see addressed. Again, you can read the list down to things like the origin of the universe and where quantum theory comes from. The standard model addresses some of these. The supersymmetric standard model, where you assume that there are light superpartners, you put that in, then addresses a bunch of others. But for example, it kind of addresses what dark matter is, but it doesn't fully, because you need something like string theory to tell you why our parity is conserved, giving you a stable dark matter. The key point is that string theory is addressing essentially everything. And as our session chair likes to emphasize, it should have two checks for at least one thing. One particular talk I want to draw attention to on using string theory to really start to work on getting neutrino masses in a systematic way, not putting in or assuming an answer in the form of some SO10 theory or something. And there'll be a nice talk on that later in the week. What about electroweak symmetry breaking? Phenomenologically, people basically always deal with that by imposing it as a condition and using it to compute certain parameters. But we need now to start really calculating. First, we need to figure out, of course, why superpartner masses are in the TEV region and not somewhere else. We need to figure out why mu is in the TEV region. And we need to calculate tangent beta top down. Tangent beta, the ratio of the valves, the two valves, isn't in the high scale theory anywhere. Of course, you have to actually do a calculation of how the valves occur before you calculate it. So we should be entering a time when we deduce electroweak symmetry breaking from the high scale theory and actually calculate the numerical value of MZ from first principles. And that's something which we should be focusing on knowing now. What about the flavor changing? Sorry, those are there's no tree-level diagram for a process B goes to SS bar S. There's a one-loop standard model diagram here. And necessarily, you'll get superpartner diagrams like this because you can't simultaneously diagonalize squarks, so they must have all squarks and quarks. So this is particularly sensitive to light superpartners. At the present time, this may not be real. I'm not arguing that there's a real effect, but it's an interesting one because there is a three standard deviation reported effect at the present time where these go into several different hadronic channels and you combine all that and the detectors. So if it persists, it would be interesting to study. And the point I want to make is that you can then ask what kind of high-scale theory. You can start with a string construction, and you can make some assumptions, and you can say, would it give flavor-changing effects of this order? In fact, these effects are of order 10% somewhere in the theory at the high scale, if you want to get what this kind of thing to be a few standard deviations. So it would probe string physics. It could arise, for example, there are two main ways it could arise that would be consistent with other things. One is from off-diagonal elements in the Kähler potential. The flavor physics is some mismatch between the superpotential and the Kähler potential. That's what's causing flavor-changing effects you can't locate away. Or you could have the Kähler potential be diagonal, but the diagonal elements of order factors of two different in size. And then when you do a rotation to the basis that's relevant, you end up generating flavor-changing effects. If there are such effects, it's interesting to probe it. It would tell you certain string approaches are working better than others. If there aren't, then one should be able to say, why not? Why is there no such effect induced? You can say similar kinds of thinking about CP violation. Where does it come from? Is it the projection of the 10-dimensional theory to 4 dimensions? Are the F-term devs that break supersymmetry complex and in such a way that you can't rotate away certain phases? It enters the 4-dimensional world via the superpotential and the Kähler potential. Theory. There must be one phase in the Yukawa couplings in the superpotential because of the CKM phase. There must be another one somewhere in the soft breaking Lagrangian because of baryogenesis. They could originate from the same underlying phase. If this process where there should be a bar over one of those was really observed, then there would have to be a third different effective phase in the soft breaking Lagrangian. But again, they could all come from an underlying geometrical phase. Very little study of this kind of thing. Collider physics and the discovery of superpartners of the Tevatron could be especially productive in terms of telling us about the theory. At the simplest level, it's because the soft Lagrangian is determined by the superpotential and the Kähler potential and the gauge kinetic function, and you get those when you go to 4D. So if we could measure the full soft breaking Lagrangian, then maybe we can go the other way and begin to learn about, move back toward the 10-dimensional theory. There are lots of things involving phases, too, and I'm going to talk a bit about that, because the soft breaking Lagrangian gas is complex. There's no known argument or symmetry that I'm aware of, at least, that tells us from first principles of line theory or from supersymmetry breaking that those phases in the effect of the masses of the soft breaking Lagrangian should be small phases. If it were, it would be very interesting. It would say both the compactification must not generate the possibility of a large phase, and the supersymmetry breaking must not allow a large phase if those phases turn out to be experimentally small. Some of those phases are constrained by electric dipole moments, but only a few. In a certain sense, there are two known electric dipole moments, so in a certain sense, two combinations are constrained. You can make it a little stronger. Those phases actually affect, and I'll say more, we're going to talk a little more about LHC physics on Wednesday, and I'll give you some details of how this works a little more if you're not familiar with it. But those phases don't just cause CP violation, they actually change your predictions dramatically for superpartner masses, production cross-sections, decays. They change the Higgs sector dramatically. They change the relic density of dark matter and the detectability of dark matter. Those phases appear all over the place. And they can have very big effects on both CP conserving and CP violating things. If you set the phases to zero when you shouldn't, it can be very misleading. For example, a few years ago, we showed that if you took the LEP limit, which was then about 95 GeV for the lightest Higgs when we did the calculation numerically, and you put in the phases simply in a general way and allowed them to be there, 95 GeV dropped down to 81 GeV. At the time, to give you a sense of the size of the effect you can get in phases. So what was reported by LEP then was only true if you ignored the phases. We can develop techniques and something, I won't say much about it, but briefly for a minute on Wednesday, but we're working on this kind of thing, to actually measure the CP violating phases and conserving ones at colliders too. Now, the bottom part of this slide is one of the most important things. So what happens when there's a signal at LHC? Well, Most string theorists are going to say, great, found supersymmetry, I already knew that, and they're going to keep on doing exactly what they've been doing. Okay, that's all right. But if you want to use the data and figure out what's going on, you've got to start trying to untangle what it tells you, and it's very difficult, particularly in hadron colliders. There's a lot of obstacles, of which I'm only going to talk about a few. First, experiments actually measure the masses of mass eigenstates, except in practice, in general, there is no way to measure individual superparticle masses of hadron collider known. For a few special cases, under certain assumptions, you can do it. But in general, you can measure some mass differences, in general case, but not actual mass of the superpartner. So if you think you can make a model and look at the superpartner masses, there'll either be none or one or two, at best if we're lucky, masses you can compare that with in the general case. What experimenters usually report is the cross-section times the branching ratio for decay into a certain kind of channel. And of course, the Lagrangians we write don't contain that sort of term in them, so it's kind of hard to translate. I'll give you examples of this in a minute, but one experimenter might say something like that. It's worse, in a sense, at a hadron collider, in the presence of a general theory, for example, the general supersymmetry soft-breaking Lagrangian, there are always more Lagrangian parameters than possible observables. So you can never, in general, actually solve the Lagrangian parameters and turn it around and try and interpret them. That's actually the strongest reason why we want a linear collider, because then there are possibilities of solving. But at the present time, we know that whatever happens, we can't have a linear collider for it. At the very incredibly optimistic earliest time, a decade after LHC turns on, and if they think we're going to wait 10 years to try and figure out the LHC physics, they're not right. Then tangent beta is one of the most important parameters that you can have, because it basically occurs in every supersymmetry prediction for everything observable. There's no known way to measure tangent beta in general at a hadron collider of any kind, or to test digital mass degeneracy and such things. In certain lucky situations, you can do some of these things, but not in general. Now let's think about what will happen by thinking about LEP for a minute. What was learned from 11 years of running LEP? Basically, three things were learned, those three things listed there. That's what we came away from LEP with in practice, plus a couple of quantitative things that were useful. So one was gauge coupling unification. One was that if you do a global fit to all the data, then you must have a light Higgs boson or the fit won't be any good in the standard model. And the third was that there are no significant deviations from the standard model. So however this basic standard model is extended must be a weakly coupled theory, because it caused at the 0.5% plus or minus a bit level in the effect. For our purposes today, the most important result is that none of these appear in the data itself. If you just measure things, there's no way you can get any clue of any of these things. You have to do a huge amount of theory, sometimes theory just learning precisely what the standard model says, and sometimes extended theories before you can figure out these main conclusions. And a secondary thing in general, or more important for other talks, is that all three of those things suggest that the supersymmetric standard model has. So what will happen at LHC? Well, first there'll be a signal, which I'm assuming will be a supersymmetry signal of some sort. And then if you don't have a lot of theory and a lot of combined work and analysis, nothing will happen. We won't figure out anything. One of the first questions that one always gets asked is it supersymmetry? And there's we're actually going through now systematically trying to figure out how to do this in an algorithmic way. But basically, if there are same sign dileptron events, they only come from Majorana fermions, which decay as themselves sometimes and as their antiparticles sometimes. And they're extremely characteristic signature of supersymmetry, and they're quite robust. Not 100% of the parameter space has it, but about 95%+ does. And if you see a few of these same side dileptron events, then it's supersymmetry almost certainly. It's very hard to fake it. We will eventually tell you why different alternatives cannot fake it, but we haven't got that. I'm going to show a few inclusive signature plots, so-called. That's an approach I've been working on for several years, and the main reference to it is this paper, Dimitri and Nelson and Leon Tawan, and there's some earlier papers which sort of feel their way around it, and some more coming. And some recent collaborators are Borgeli and Kumar and Kinwan. And I'll show you some of this stuff. Everything I say about signatures always assumes a missing transverse energy above 100 GeV, and we're assuming it removes all standard model background. So there's no, we haven't done any of the experimenter kind of data analysis, cutting away the standard model and so forth. We just assume with these cuts it's not there. So this is an instructive graph. Here is what we're calling inclusive signature plots. This shows the cross-section for producing opposite sign deltas plus two or more jets, all appropriately defined. I'll show you some definitions of these things at the end, versus the cross-section for no lepton events with two or more jets. That is just two or more appropriate jets. And one lesson to learn is in this blue region, the approach called MSUGRA, where you assume that all the 105 or so parameters of the soft breaking Lagrangian reduce to four parameters that are real, and then you can actually, on this plot, or on any kind of plot, find the entire region that can populate. No letting the parameters range over all possible values that are not already excluded by experiment. You must be in this blue region. So if there's a single data point outside of that region when you look at data, and you can make these plots for many different kinds of things, and I'll show you a few more later on. If there's a single point outside for any plot, then that model is simply excluded. These three are just points to show you that if you take simple string constructions and make some assumptions and go down to low energy data, you get this point and this point and this point. It's very easy to lie outside that region. So this just says the same thing. You can make many such plots. This shows you that you can get more ambitious. Here are trilepton events and same sign dilepton events. The definition doesn't matter if you're not familiar. These are, the alphabetic letters are a bunch of different string constructions. And the only point I want to make here is that they lie all over the plot. Each of these points is for a particular set of parameters in there. And if you let it vary over all the parameters, they spread out over some region. But they don't cover all the points. And if you make different kinds of plots, then they lie in different places. And so a string construction, including its assumptions, can be probed by this kind of analysis in a systematic way. And as we get more knowledgeable and better, we can do more. To do all that, you have to take a high-scale theory. Then you have to look at the normalization of equations called low-scale, and there are programs that you can use to do that. One is Specspec 2, which is what we use for these kinds of analyses. After you calculate a spectrum, then you can calculate production cross-sections and events, and you use another program called Pythia to produce those events and impose the cuts, and you can hope to reverse the direction. So now let's turn to the report of the first run of the LHC, and you can then try and untangle it. I don't know what the organizers want to do. We can post this talk anywhere they want if people want to actually go to it. Here's one data point. This is the cross-section then in femtobarns, so about four femtobarns, for trilepton events with two or more jets versus the cross-section for same-sign dilepton events with two or more jets. It comes in a 10 inverse femtobarns is the luminosity of the machine for 1 year at 10 to the 33 luminosity. 10 inverse femtobarns is the integrated luminosity. So if you have a cross-section of four femtobarns, that would correspond to about 40 events above background of that kind. And here, I forget, this number is 16 or something, 14. So 140. In the first year of LHC running, if they run at a tenth of their design luminosity, just to give you a feeling for the numbers of events. Here's a second graph like that. That's the cross-section, again, in femtobarns for opposite sign dileptons greater than or equal to two jets versus one lepton with greater than or equal to two jets. And you can make any number of these plots. Here's a table of cross-sections in femtobarns. Instead of showing you lots of plots, I'm summarizing the rest in a table. These are events with two jets, three jets. I'll show you the cuts in a minute. And with greater than 3 jets, and these are no leptons, one opposite sign dilepton, same sign dileptons, and trileptons. Let me leave that for just a second while you copy it down if you want, or I can go back to it later. But this is what you're going to get, basically, from experimenters. There's going to be a series of talks at the first meeting, and they're going to, each talk will tell you their analysis and their backgrounds and cuts and how they generated these kinds of numbers. Then someone will give a talk explaining that for events with opposite sign dileptons and greater than or equal, well, in any number of jets, in fact, and large missing transverse energy, that if you plot the invariant mass of the dilepton opposite sign pair, it has an endpoint at 20 GeV. So that's a kinematical distribution, which tells you something about the masses. And there's another kinematical plot. If you take all the channels that have no leptons in them, then the sum of the, and you plot, you define a variable which is basically all of the energy, the sum of the missing transverse energy and the transverse momentum of all jets, that has a peak at 715 GeV in this data. The cuts that are used, I won't go through in detail. Again, we can go back to this, but they're pretty standard cuts, missing transverse momentum, a lepton, and something inside the rapidity less than 5 region, only electron or muon, and transverse momentum greater than 20 GeV, an appropriate criterion for isolation, and a plane that cuts away jets faking missing transverse energy. So to conclude, just two things that I hope you really remember. One is that string phenomenology is, in fact, here to stay, and it's going to get a lot bigger and more active and hopefully successful. And second, it's going to be really hard to learn any implications of LHC data and take a lot of work and thinking by a lot of people who understand what they're doing. So let's start. Thank you.
Are there questions for Gordy? Plenty of time.
Yeah, anyway, I didn't make a particular Xerox, but we can print this or whatever people want. I can email it to anyone. It's in, now that I'm, this is only my second PowerPoint talk ever, and it worked, so I'm happy. But I can send it to anybody, or we can post it, or, yeah, whatever the organizers want.
But no one should tell the media that Gordy already knows the results if we don't need it.
And soon everybody in the room will have figured it out. Right. I didn't want to cover everything at once. The Higgs discovery is more difficult by quite a bit. These are easy. You just see 5 events with same sign dileptons and large missing energy, and you know you found a new signal. The standard model doesn't give any. You might fake one or two with a detector, of course, but that's an analysis that's under control. So this will come. This could come quite early. It could come after months of reasonable running, even. In the Higgs case, you have to look at the channels that you can do this in. One is the famous gamma-gamma, Higgs to gamma-gamma. That's going to depend on knowing the resolution of the detector into 2 photons beautifully. And it could come also within a few months, but it's going to take a really serious detector analysis that you don't have to do here. And that's why it'll be delayed. And anyhow, I actually think the Higgs signal should be reported at Fermilab before LHC gets to it. But that requires Fermilab working at least as well as it is, if not a little better, then it should get there in a year or so and start to see events. But I don't know that that'll actually happen. Then there are lots of other channels you can use at LHC, and the real discovery will take 2 channels to confirm it. So you trigger on top quarks or Ws and use some channel. The best channel will be actually decay of superpartners into Higgses, but there's no analysis of that done by LHC people yet. That may actually be the way it's discovered.
Any other questions for Gordy? I don't see any hands. So in that case, once more. And the next next speaker is another of my favorite spring phenomenologists, Bert Overath. His title is A Heterotic Standard Model.